hello to you. Well, the health service is bracing itself for the COVID-19 onslaught. We have public health officials pleading with people, pleading with you to stick to the advice, to wash your hands, to keep social distance. But this coronavirus pandemic has had a massive health and economic impact already in this country. I'm joined today by Minister Regina Doherty of Fine Gael, Minister for Employment Affairs and Social Protection for Fine Gael, Professor Sam McConkie, who's head of the Department of International Health and Tropical Medicine at the RCSI University of Medicine and Health Sciences. I'm joined by Tony Foley, Emeritus Associate Professor of Economics at DCU Business School. And on the line is Dr. John Bates, who's an ICU consultant, anaesthetist, and Dean of the Joint Faculty of Intensive Care Medicine of Ireland. We'll talk later in the programme to Piers Doherty of Sinn Féin and Mary McAleese, former president, among others. But can I turn to you, Sam McConkie, first of all? We heard Dr. Colm Henry, along with Brendan O'Connor, earlier on. He said this is for the long haul. We heard the Taoiseach mention May in terms of the restrictions. How long, if this is the calm before the storm, can you chart for us, before you tell us how long you think the restrictions should be in place for, if this is the calm before the storm, what can we expect in the coming days?
So the best way I have of looking at the answers to that question are really by seeing what happened in China. In China, they introduced severe restrictions in Wuhan on the 23rd of January, 12 other cities 24th of January, and then went on holidays for the Chinese New Year on the 25th of January and stayed on holidays for several months. And it was really only on the 5th of February, which was about 12 days later, that the number of new cases of coronavirus, COVID-19, started to decrease in China. So I'm really hoping that in the next week that we do start to see an improvement in our patterns here based on what happened in China. The Chinese prolonged their Chinese New Year for a very long time. They closed most of their non-essential industry. They actually switched off a big chunk of their economy. That bit that wasn't involved in healthcare or internet or security, they actually just switched off all the non-essential bit. And a lot of it is still off. And they're now just gradually getting back to work and trying to see how can we safely start relocating people from the rural areas where they grew up back into the big cities and starting to get the factories going.
2 weeks ago, I sat in the studio and we discussed with the panel, it was the day that Italy was supposed to play Ireland in Dublin, and an awful lot of Italian fans had still travelled to Dublin. And I asked if people should be wary of sitting near groups of Italians, and I knew it was a really weird question. Mm. Looking back now, I wonder if travel to and from affected areas had been curtailed from here a little bit quicker, yeah, and if pubs and restaurants had been shut, hotels a little bit quicker, pubs, yeah, and hotels, yeah, would it have affected the outcome?
So in medicine we call this the retrospectoscope, meaning that with the benefit of hindsight it's very obvious what should have been done, and that's completely different. I would put out to your listeners that we need to bring everyone with us in what we're doing. My view is we need one national voice that guides us in what we should do, mm-hmm, and then we all need to chip in beside it and buy into those measures. And if you start too early, nobody follows you, and if you only lead with a few percent of people following you, you're not really a leader. So we actually need some national unity in this, okay, and we find mechanisms of government that lead to those joint universal adherence to the measures.
Before I come to the minister, the previous question relates to this question, because if it's all about flattening the curve, should we not take a sledgehammer to this right now and restrict all unnecessary journeys and restrict any travel outside of the house unless you're going to the pharmacy and unless you're going to a food shop?
So that is one of a suite of measures that I've no doubt is being considered if we're not seeing that the curve is dramatically starting to stop with the current measures. So that's just one of several. We could look at also people coming into the country from outside, maybe doing 2 weeks of forced isolation, quarantine if you like, before they start to mix into Irish society. We could again scale up our testing, scale up our contact tracing, scale up isolation of first and maybe even second degree contacts. So there's a whole suite of possibilities. I don't think it's just a crude sledgehammer. It needs to be a bit more nuanced and planned than that.
Is that being considered, Minister?
I think what we're being told, and again the recommendations are always coming from the medical experts fielded through Tony Houlihan, which I think we do all have 100% confidence in. Mm-hmm. There has to be the right reaction at the right time for the right amount of time. And if we do something too early, well, then I think the fear is that if it goes on longer than you think it might go on, then you lose people. And that's, there's no point in us all making massive sacrifices to halfway through it for us to lose people and those sacrifices to be, you know, a waste of time. So
should restaurants and cafes, sit down restaurants and cafes, be closed at this point? Is that being considered?
So the last meeting that we had with Dr. Houlihan was only this week. His advice is, as issued by the HSE, is that if social distancing can be adhered to, then people should carry on in those type of services industries, because there is a huge benefit for society, for our societal mental health and our positive attitudes, to be able to maintain some semblance of social interaction while social distancing. Now, there are some organisations that just can't do that, and if they can't adhere to the social guidelines, distancing guidelines, then they should close down. And Dr. Houlihan's offer on Tuesday of this week was that he would meet with organisations to ensure that they do adhere to the guidelines, and if they can't, well, then they will have to close down.
I spoke with a GP yesterday, and she told me that she had a patient last Monday, referred the case on Monday for testing, and by Friday was still waiting. Some people are waiting 5 or more days for a test.
Yeah, I think I saw that reported in the papers, I think, this morning. And so you can see that we're drastically increasing the number of places that you can now go and get a test. I think we're up to 29 today, and that's only going to increase. The people that are being drafted in to do the tests are being recruited at the moment. The tests are being flown in, you know, by their tens of thousands every day, and we're going to increase. Like the WHO advice, and the doctor obviously will tell this far better than I do, testing, testing, testing. If anything you're going to do is to test.
Yeah, but it's obviously not happening quick enough. The IMO are saying people are waiting between 5 and 10 days. Now, everybody is understanding that all the services are under huge pressure. But isn't it a worry for us that if you're waiting 5 days for a test, you could be some number of days before that where you have no symptoms whatsoever and still infecting people? You're waiting 5 days for a test before it really hits home that you have this disease, and you could be infecting or laissez-faire about restrictions or self-isolation.
Well, I would hope that you're not being laissez-faire, and I don't think people are, and so I do appreciate that there are people concerned that they're waiting a long time for the test. But as soon as you've ordered your test, the advice of your doctor is to self-isolate and to protect you and your family, and I would hope and I do expect that that's what everybody is doing. And so I would ask, I know people are frustrated and are afraid, but the tests are being done and we're ramping up as absolutely fast as we can, and we're recruiting, as you can see, from some 50,000 Irish people have responded to the Ireland On Call,
which is incredible. But I wonder,
it is,
Sam McConkie,
so we're doing it as fast as we can.
Are doctors telling people as they wait for the test to self-isolate as though they had the test, have the virus?
Yes, that's correct.
Yes, that's what's happening.
Oh yes, once you're eligible for the test and the results are not back yet, you're essentially in the self-isolation completely. That's exactly correct.
Can I ask you about some of the reports of young people and the Taoiseach Simon Coveney, I would say, was quite irate in the Shannon in terms of how he responded. What was your reading of that, Sam McConkie, in terms of they should be confronted, young people? And I know some people are saying it's middle-aged and older people as well, but groups of people who are congregating and obviously not respecting the restrictions, what to do?
So I think there's a really fundamental point underneath all this. To what extent we want to live in a sort of totalitarian, authoritarian, command and control state, and to what extent we want to live in a state of citizens that are empowered to live the life with some of the freedoms we can do. And there's a conflict there, because some of the restrictions on infectious require restricting people's movements, and that's something we're not used to doing in most liberal democracies, of restricting
people's
movements.
They're doing it in Spain, though, weren't they?
So my view is that this is taking away a very fundamental human right, and before we start even doing that and implementing it, we need to really have some really detailed cross-party discussion. I have proposed before getting a joint Oireachtas committee on many of these topics. There are about 8 or 10 key fundamental things that we really need cross-party agreement on before we start really rigidly enforcing, with the rule of law, if you like, these. For example, using GPS tags to see where people go who've got it, using GPS to do contact tracing. These are things that have been challenged in our courts, as you know, in criminal prosecutions. So this is not a simple thing. But my view is that the 160 folk elected to Dáil Éireann a few months ago should really be working on that in small groups to come up with a centrist, broadly acceptable way forward for these very divisive suggestions.
I'm going to bring in the consultant, Tony Bates, in just one second. But a quick one for you on testing, Regina Doherty. A texter says, it was announced that 30,000 coronavirus testing kits were delivered on Thursday. On Wednesday, Simon Harris said we would need to test 10,000 to 15,000 people each day. Does that mean we'll run out of test kits in the coming days?
No. So Paul Reid and his team have spent a considerable amount of time in the last week, and very successfully have ordered not only probably thousands and thousands of testing kits, but they have ordered new ventilators. We've ordered massive volumes of the personal protective equipment that's going to be needed by our medical doctors and nurses who are on the front line, and all of that's ordered, and obviously they have started to try and identify and book some beds that's available in the private sector, some beds that might be considered isolation units if and when we ever need them. So they have done enormous amounts of work, and we will not run out of tests. What we are planning to do is to increase and test and test and test, and the venues of which obviously people will be sent for those tests by their GPs will go to
increase.
People
are really worried about this. The texter says, my son and myself were referred by our separate GPs on last Monday. If we haven't heard back by Wednesday, we're told to contact them again. We were also told it could be at any time between now and then. That's just too long, isn't it? Appreciating that it's difficult.
Well, again, if the person, and I don't say this, you know, in any way disrespectful, if the person are self-isolating, well, then they're doing what they would be doing
anyway
if the test was positive anyway. So it's just to ask people to bear with us, and I'm not trying to be smart. We're trying to do in a number of days what, if you were to plan to do, would probably take months, if not years, to set up a system. And so everybody is working really hard to try and give the response to the medical crisis that we're in.
I know you want to come back in, Sam McConkie, but I'm going to bring in John Bates and let you back in just one second. John Bates, Dr. John Bates, you're very welcome to the programme. You're an ICU intensive care unit consultant. We're waiting for the surge, or should I say you're waiting for the surge. How is the service coping at the moment?
Well, I mean, the surge hasn't happened yet, which is the first thing to say, but we are using the time very carefully to get as many, to increase capacity to the degree that we can. There are a number of components to that. We have a bit of surge capacity on the medical side because all anaesthesiologists in Ireland are trained in intensive care medicine, and they can be redeployed from theatre, which means that we do have some surge capacity there. In terms of equipment, there's a lot of equipment has been procured and some of it has started to arrive. And we've looked at all areas in different hospitals around the country. They're all looking at areas which can be kitted out as intensive care units. I think the main problem we're going to have is with intensive care nursing. We have, you know, very good intensive care nurses in Ireland, but we don't have enough of them. And it's all going to be a question of what degree we can stretch that.
How many more do we need, John?
Well, we're not going to get as many as we need. So what we're doing at the moment is redeploying nurses from other areas who have comparable skills to critical care. And we're using the time at the moment to upskill those groups of nurses so that they can work as intensive care nurses.
And what's the deficit, though, in terms of the... Or do you have that number in terms of ICU nurses?
I don't have the number. I suppose the first thing to say is that every healthcare system in the world and every intensive care unit, every intensive care capacity in the world is going to be challenged by this. So it's a question of how many beds we can actually, to what extent we can extend the service. In terms of beds, we normally have about 257 is the normal number, and we're trying to get to double that or possibly more. And we're essentially trying to get as many as we can.
Can I ask you about that? Because I have a query in terms of the ICU beds. Let's say we have 250+ beds at the moment. They are occupied largely, aren't they?
They are occupied, although there's been a reduction in occupancy because major high-risk surgery has been deferred where it can be. So there is a little bit more capacity coming into the system now.
So when you say
are normally occupied, yeah.
Yeah, so when you say we have 250-odd beds, now I know some have been occupied, but when you want to double that, you're only releasing, for the COVID patients, 250, is that correct?
Well, you're probably releasing more than that, as I said, because there will be a reduction in surgery, which can be deferred, which actually does give you additional capacity
If we're to have 15,000 cases by the end of the month here, can I ask you the nightmare scenario? What happens if you have more cases of intensive care than you have beds and nurses to deal with?
So I guess we're doing everything we can not to get into that scenario, and the social distancing is absolutely crucial to that, and it's more important, in fact, than trying to expand bed numbers. So just to reiterate that, what happens, I guess, is that we have to use what resources we have to the greatest good. So in this case, it will be to save the maximum number of lives. And it's a scenario we don't want to be in. But there is guidance from the Medical Council and from the WHO pandemic influenza document to, we will do as much as we can with the resources we have, but it may be a very difficult situation, which is why it's so important that everybody follows HSE advice and does exactly what they're told to do and complies with social distancing at this point.
That's going to be very tough on the families, obviously, but also on staff, if it's a case of choosing which life to save.
Yes, it is, and I guess it's a situation none of us have been in before. We will have multiple different, I guess, we will be consulting with colleagues. But we are used to making difficult decisions in intensive care. We get the sickest patients in the hospital, the mortality rate is high, and there are people who do not benefit from intensive care. So we are used to kind of being in that space.
Can I ask about your colleagues, yourself and your colleagues, and your exposure to the virus? We know that 114 healthcare workers have contracted the virus as of now. That's an obvious worry because you're especially important in terms of dealing with the crisis. Do you have enough protective equipment and gear?
I suppose the surge hasn't happened yet, so I don't know. It's certainly there at the moment, but I know there has been difficulties worldwide with procuring it. We will lose staff, and that's going to be difficult. Staff will come down with COVID-19, which is going to be difficult with maintaining capacity as well as everything else. And I know that about 20% of staff working in Italian intensive cares contacted COVID at some point. But I really can't say. We are concerned about having enough PPE, but we just have to see what happens when the surge actually does happen. I think it's important to remind everybody not to waste it. There are specific indications and specific times when you need to wear full PPE and other times when you don't. So it's just important that we use it when necessary and then save it for when it's necessary.
Okay, and briefly, finally, John, what's the morale like? What's the mood like? I spoke to one nurse in Tala during the week. She said people are ready. They're not too fatigued at the moment, but they are nervous in terms of frontline staff. What's your reading of it?
I think everybody's nervous, but I do think that I've never seen anybody or any group of people as motivated to up capacity and look after as many patients as they can at this time. So I think everybody's nervous, but everybody's doing everything that they can to pump up capacity to the degree that we can.
Okay, look, Dr. John Bates, ICU consultant, thank you very much indeed. And I hope you realise, I'm sure you do, that you have the public's respect and appreciation and all of your colleagues as well. You were telling me, Sam McConkie, off air, that this is, you liken this or you compare it to a situation where you worked in Sierra Leone, is that right?
Well, yeah, so in 93 and 94, I spent a couple of years with a group of Irish nuns called the Holy Rosary Sisters as a medical superintendent of a mission hospital in West Africa. Back in the past, there were many, many such hospitals in Africa and Asia, and then we got stuck in the Sierra Leonean civil war, a lot of rebels, a lot of fighting going on, and then I was tasked with a group of people making decisions about how we react to that. When do we stop looking after people? How do we escalate our plans? So we did contingency planning. We had 7 points in contingency plan. We had that all in advance 6 months before they arrived at our hospital, and we ended up implementing all 7 of those and actually closing down the hospital. Several people we knew got killed, and a lot of people we knew got kidnapped. So it was truly a very, very, very dangerous war.
It's frightening to us that that's a comparable situation in your eyes in some ways. I must say personally, I'm frightened when I talk to the likes of John Bates and yourself and when medical staff say that it may come to a point if the curve isn't flattened enough where they decide which life they can save. And then I look at texts like this from Dan in Cork, who says, just back from a walk around Cork City, people of all ages, barber shop with customers sitting, waiting 2 feet apart, pharmacy queue 2 to 3 feet apart, English market customers queuing alongside each other at fresh food counters, the mind boggles, lockdown now. I must say, I am worried personally. Am I wrong to be?
No, I think we're right that this is I would describe it as a slow-moving tsunami that's going to roll over Ireland in the next sort of 8, 10, 15, 20 days.
And our behaviour can control how that moves and how big it is. I feel we have implemented a suite of measures which I strongly support, and I think there almost certainly will be more. I find lockdown too vague and too frightening to be useful as a word, but it may involve restrictions of personal movement of people, and that's what I'm saying. We need consensus that's agreeable.
One brief one, Minister, before we go to the break. Cormac, could you ask Sam and Regina, should all barbershops and hairdressers be closed due to social distancing? I've closed my barbershop business last week, temporary layoff of 10 staff, but notice there are some still open. We are doing our part. We have received no instruction from government. Should I and my staff just go back to work? Says Declan in Dublin 11.
So the medical advice is that if you can continue to operate adhering to the social distancing rules that have been, or guidelines that have been issued by the HSE, then the encouragement is to continue to do so. Now, this is my personal view. I live in a little village called Ratose. Most of our barbers have closed because they feel they can't adhere to the social distancing. And there was one absolutely thriving, as your gentleman there in Cork.
Yep.
And they're being blacklisted by everybody else who's as concerned as you are. So if you can't adhere to the social distancing, which is 2 metres apart, then close down. If you can, well, then we obviously encourage people to keep going. But like it's not rocket science.
Yeah, think of the slow-moving tsunami, as Sam McConkie put it, of death, really, which is making its way towards us without being... And that's not being in any way dramatic when you listen to the experts. But look, this is having a massive public health impact and societal impact, and also a massive economic impact as well. And we're going to discuss that just after a very, very quick break.
Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back to the programme. Keep the text coming in. 51551. I'm with Minister Regina Doherty of Fine Gael, Professor Sam McConkie, Tony Foley of DCU, and we have Piers Doherty of Sinn Féin on the line, who I'll come to right now. You're very welcome to the programme, Piers. A raft of things have been announced by the government, by the minister here and her colleagues. No evictions during the pandemic period, no rent increases, pandemic payment, illness benefit for those in self-isolation, various schemes to finance business and so on. But 140,000 people have lost their jobs or have had their work impacted. You say the government is not doing enough to help those people. In what way?
Well, I think what we need to do, obviously, is we need to take all the health advice and try to suppress as much as we can this crisis, the health crisis. But there is also an economic crisis, that there's an income crisis, and we need a bailout for workers and for families. Those people, as you say, that have lost their jobs, I imagine that at this point, Cormac, that number is significantly increased, and unfortunately there will be many other tens of thousands who will lose their jobs over the next period of time, as we need to increase the restrictions that simply aren't taking place in many workplaces, and people are questioning us as to, you know, that they're isolating at the weekend, that they're following all the health advice, and that they're going into work, and that there's no concept of social distancing there.
What specifically, Piers Doherty, do you mean by a bailout for workers?
Well, what we need to do is we know that this is going to be temporary. We know that this is a supply issue. We know that these businesses that have had to close their doors were viable, and they want to get back up and running on the other side of this crisis. And we have to have an eye to ensuring that we can restart and reboot the economy as quickly as possible in all of our interests. So what we need to do, in my view, is maintain the incomes of those people who have been temporarily laid off. You've seen other jurisdictions where they have announced different schemes from 70 to 90% of income protection for workers with certain caps. We have our own type of scheme that we've proposed today to the government. And what we're suggesting is that there would be income guarantees of up to €525 per week. That means that somebody who has lost their job as a result of this virus would be protected their full income up to an amount of €32,500 per year. Those that are above that would also get the same supports of €525 per week, and allow employers to top up with solidarity payments. Mm-hmm. It should also apply to the self-employed. And it's crucial that we do not have a debt crisis or an income crisis on the other side of this here. We need the capacity of families to be able to, you know, meet their bills, heat their homes, put food on the table, pay their rents and all of the rest. And the only way of doing that is supporting their income during this crisis.
Can I
but
put
we also
that to
need
the
to
minister?
Make sure that there's money in the economy when these businesses businesses reopen in 3 or 4 months' time.
Can I put that to the Minister? An awful lot of talk about this €203 payment per week that you've announced. IMEC opposition saying it's too little. Do you recognise that it is, or are you sticking to that?
So can I, in the first instance, can I say that we're in the middle of a profoundly serious health crisis and it will end. And what we're trying to do at the moment is to make sure that a temporary economic interruption doesn't turn into a permanent crisis with regard to employment. And so last Sunday, and it's only last Sunday, it's not even a week ago, when we sat down to recognise that we were going to have tens of thousands of people coming within a matter of days, that the current system that we had for normal times wasn't going to be sufficient. That's when we came up with the one-page application to get you in, get you on a payment of €203 a week. We decided last Sunday that it would be a temporary payment for 6 weeks because we felt that during that 6 weeks period, we'd get you onto the right scheme. And the right scheme would be JB or JA or for the self-employed scheme. And all of those schemes have extra conditionality. So if you have independent adults or dependent adults, you get more money. If you have children, you get more money. If you have rent, you get more money. You know, there's add-ons to all of those things. Now, that was on Sunday. So sorry, Cormac, just for 1 second. Yeah. That was on Sunday. Since we made that decision on Sunday, we have 90,000 people have applied for that emergency application. And so now, since Thursday of this week, we recognise that because we've done the numbers and the modelling, and we know even conservatively the amount of people that are going to be affected from an income perspective over the coming weeks, that isn't going to work and it isn't going to be sufficient. And so we have started looking at other ways of supporting the incomes of people who either have lost their jobs already or potentially could or will lose their jobs in the number of weeks. And again, can I say, I know everybody is clamouring that, you know, different industries and organisations came out with ideas yesterday and they want us to jump up and say, this is what we're doing today. If I sat here in front of you today and I said, we're going to do this, and you said to me, how are you going to do it? How much is it going to cost? How long was it last? And I don't have those answers for you.
But you'll appreciate that people are worried.
Absolutely.
I mean, they've lost their jobs. Absolutely. And now they're facing into weeks, more than 6 weeks. Just finish the point.
Sorry.
They believe that they're facing into, they've told us, more than 6 weeks. The Taoiseach has mentioned May. Of restrictions or loss of job or loss of income, and they have to live on €203 a week. Now, how do I pay my rent if it's €1,005 or €1,800 on €203 a week?
So we're not expecting you to do that. And so the world has a very different place this Saturday than it was last Sunday when we made the emergency payment decision. And it was genuinely made in the fullness that we would get people onto the right schemes within a matter of weeks. It was only an emergency payment to make sure that you cooked food on your table. The world is a very different place 6 days later, and we now recognise that we will have to do something much different to the emergency payment.
Will it be like the UK approach, where you get 80% of your wage guaranteed?
I can't give you the details right yet, Cormac, but what I'm telling you is that we are working on it since Thursday. We worked all day yesterday, we're working all day today, and I hope in the next number of days for the Minister for Finance to be able to make an announcement of what it will be.
And I'm not going to push you too hard, because I know this is a crisis, and I know it's really intense. But when will you know? Because people are waiting.
So we're working today. We'll work tomorrow if we have to. I would hope at the very early beginning of next week. And it's not the, you know, it sounds very easy to say this is what you should do. And it would be very easy for me to say this is what we'll do. But if I can't tell you how we'll do it, and if I can't tell, you know, workers how they deal with their payroll and employers.
Will
and
it be done by the end of next week, this week coming?
I would be very hopeful that we will be in a position at the beginning of the week.
Can I bring in Aideen Hayden? Put on your headphones. I have Piers Sarty with me still. I'll go back to you, Piers, and Tony Foley. But Aideen Hayden, you're chairperson of Threshold. People are extremely worried about paying the rent, because it's not just, we know they have a guarantee, or so we're told, of no evictions during this pandemic period. But if repayments build up, what are you proposing? What are you hopeful for in terms of renters?
Well, first of all, can I just say we're very happy to see the moratorium, both on evictions and on rent increases, though I think the idea of rent increases in this environment is a joke. But could I just say we are very concerned about the fact that eligibility, for example, for rent supplement, which is Minister Doherty's department, is clearly the way forward for people who have been working and who are now finding themselves in the position that they find themselves in. There is a couple of issues with that scheme, as the Minister is, I'm sure, well aware herself. The applicant application itself is 28 pages long. You can't get rent supplement if one member of the household is working in employment. Now, if you take that into context, the average rent in Dublin is 2,000 euros. The rent supplement limit itself is 1,300 euros. So even if the family were getting the 1,300 euros, they'd be 700 euros short at a very minimum. On top of that, they wouldn't be eligible. Over and above that, you have to get the landlord's consent to receive rent supplement. So we're saying there are many, many, many issues with rent supplement, which is the obvious place for people who have been in work to go that need to be resolved. And I would say, Cormac, one thing that concerns us,
yeah,
an awful lot of the people who would be suffering now from unemployment are people who are living in the private rented sector. They're going to be the most badly hit of any group. We're very worried, for example, about issues such as overcrowding in the sector, which is people are calling us every day because they're sharing bedrooms, for example. We're also very concerned about people who aren't protected at all. People who are licensees, for example, who are in the rent a room scheme, who would not be eligible for support from the minister.
Are you saying specifically relax the rules around rent supplement and increase rent supplement? Is that your call?
Absolutely, we are.
Minister, is that something you're looking at?
So again, to answer your question, no, because normal schemes work in normal times. And if we got an onslaught of applications for rent supplements, I need available people to be able to go through those 28 pages. And even if we reduced it to 2 pages, I still need available people to be able to go through all of the applications. And if I give you an example of the 100,000 or so that applied to us this week, that's about 5 months' work for our normal staff to do normal processing.
So you're faced with your own tsunami
of
paperwork.
What that tells you is that the normal response is not going to work. And so changing rent supplement or thinking that we can get people onto, you know, a scheme in the next couple of weeks.
Look, I don't want
so
to
that's why we have to have an extraordinary
Minister,
response.
I don't want to worry people.
No,
who are looking to you now today, who are saying, I'm living on 203 yeah. euros a week. You're not, and I appreciate it's uncertain times, but you're not giving any guarantee in terms of wages. You're saying you're not looking at rent supplement.
So what I'm saying to you is that we recognise there is a draw on people's incomes, a massive draw on people's incomes for those people who have lost or are potentially going to lose their job. What I'm suggesting to you is in normal times, of all of the places that you would send people, so for a medical card free transport.
Are you talking about a new scheme then?
So,
but it's precisely because of the inadequacies of the present system that we need a new system.
Yes.
The minister could, not so much the minister herself, but the government could solve the problem now by saying the COVID payment of 203 is now going to be 503. And it's going to last for 6 weeks as it is. We'll review it at the end of the situation. And that would go part of the way towards that minimum guarantee from Pearce. It would also give some extra money. Now, in a sense, the funny thing is we need money for rent and bills. We don't need money to go out and spend because we can't go out and spend it. But in terms of rent, in terms of utility bills and so on, clearly the 203 is not going to work. So why can't we just make it 5 right away, immediately announcement?
Why
it's going
to
cost
the UK?
Billions. Well, if you do the UK one, you're
80% guaranteed of your wage.
You're into all the main attraction of the wage subsidy is it links the workers to the business so that when we have the recovery, it's not that you've gone off and got another job and so on, and it's then hard to get the recovery going. The problem with it is, what do you define as? Is it everybody's wages? Is it people who are going to be unemployed? And if, say, for example, it's people who are going to be unemployed, so we subsidise their wages so they're not unemployed, well, then what about the other 1.5 million who now might say, well, they were going to be unemployed as well, and then maybe we end up subsidising in terms of dead weight lots of businesses which weren't going to get rid of their workers. Now, if we're willing to accept that price, yes, we can do it. But a quicker way of doing it, but it doesn't keep that link with the workers, with the business, is we raise the COVID payment. I mean, the minister has recognised that it's not enough to do what we hope it would do. I agree totally with her that it's inconceivable that the sector, in terms of looking after public sector payments, looking after social welfare payments, could deal with what I am. If we were talking about it later, I'd be saying might be 700,000 people unemployed. The system cannot
700,000.
We could well have that.
By when?
We could have that within a week or 2 weeks. The minister originally a few days ago talked about 400,000. She recently revised that to 500,000, and that could easily be 700,000. We could, if we look at it in the other direction, suppose we have a complete shutdown and we only have essential tasks being performed, such as food production, health sector, security, supermarkets and so on. That would be about 900,000 people working in those essential activities. There's another 1.4 million people who then would be in complete lockdown and wouldn't be working.
Is this worse than 2008, 2010?
It is.
In terms of the economy now.
And 2010 is chicken feed. Brexit is a stroll in the park compared to what this may occur. The one good thing about this is we hope, fingers crossed, and hoping Tom is right, that it will be a short problem. That will be 3 months or 6 months, that it's not going to be possibly dragging on for years. So I would be working on the basis that we hopefully, and Tom would be the expert in this.
Sam
would be the expert in this, and we'd maximise the incidence around sort of June. We would be slowing down towards September in terms of the incidence of the disease, and we'd be gradually getting back to activity August, September and so on. So we need to be planning for maybe 700,000 people unemployed for several months.
Piers Doherty, what's your reaction to that?
I think Tony's spot on, and that's exactly what we're calling for. This can be done simply. It can be done by increasing the existing payment that's there, that is still filtered through the employers, because it's important that these employers and employees are connected. The key thing is, while we deal with the health crisis, we need to be in a position to respond and get this economy back up and running. But the other part of it is we cannot create a debt crisis or an income crisis in family homes at this point in time. So we need an income guarantee. And I appreciate that we're responding to a health crisis that we've never seen the likes of before. And many of us still don't know the full impact that this is going to be on us. But we've seen other jurisdictions come out and give certainty to workers, to families and to businesses. We need to give that certainty. Okay. We need to step up. There is a proposal here that we're putting on the table. It means everybody with incomes, weekly incomes of less than 525 will have the income guaranteed. And those above that will get that 525. And that's crucially important for employers. I'm talking to businesses who are talking about, should we be just closing our doors? Should we be just locking up? Or is there a chance that we'll ever get back to work? They need this type of certainty. They're asking me, will something come down the line? I'm telling them, of course something's coming down the line. There is going to be a bailout required, and this bailout will be huge in scale. But it's important that we make sure that those who are beneficiaries of the bailout aren't those who benefited 10 years ago in our previous bailout, which was the bankers and investors and all the rest. It needs to be ordinary workers and families.
Aideen, briefly, before I go back to the Minister.
Cormac, may I say something? I don't really care what way the minister delivers the money. That's not really the issue. It's as long as it's delivered. But I do also want to highlight the plight of people like licensees who are literally being evicted, particularly non-nationals, because of the fear that's there when people who want to self-isolate. We need to find a solution for them. We need to find additional accommodation. We're asking people to self-distance. We're asking them to stay apart. That cannot happen in some of the situations that people are living in, either in the private rental sector or in situations like rent a room schemes. It's becoming really problematic and we really need to address it.
Yet we've seen, Minister, a raft of properties that weren't on the market for rent before this week previously probably Airbnb properties, and that's something you didn't tackle when you were when you had power and you were in the teeth of a housing and homelessness crisis.
I can't answer for what we did or we didn't do a number of weeks ago, but what I tell you, the amount of properties that are now available to rent, even in Dublin alone, may come useful in the next number of weeks. And so there's never an ill wind. Maybe that doesn't blow some good.
One of the things we have to be conscious of is that this is a hugely, enormously difficult situation. So ideally what you want are simple solutions. Yeah. And the simple solutions, unfortunately, will have the knock-on effects that you get it and you didn't deserve it and so on. And we have to accept that. It is not possible to go through the whole rigmarole of the usual application for social welfare payment. And to be fair to the COVID payment people, they're getting 203. It could well have been the case that this is a person with a dependent and three kids who should have been getting 350. So he's not even, or he or she, are not even getting their entitlements because of the absolute impossibility of managing.
So when you
all
say simple solutions is maybe the COVID payment increased. That could be done quickly. The WHO, Dr. Mike Ryan, man said, look, perfection is the enemy here. So I wonder, should you proceed on that basis? And by the end of the week, can you guarantee people that they will have confirmation that they won't be, that they'll have enough to live on, enough to pay rent?
So let me give you the first guarantee is that whatever we introduce, and we will do it very soon, It will be built to have an impactful response to the drastic drop in income that people will feel if they lose their jobs. That's the guarantee that I give you, is that what we're doing and why we're doing it is to recognise that we need to keep people at a certain income level.
Just to push you a little bit, but by when, please?
As I said to you, we worked all day yesterday, we're working all day today. If it's ready tomorrow, it'll be tomorrow. If it's ready on Monday, it'll be Monday. But the reason it isn't as simple as just saying we're going to do, you know, X amount of euros tomorrow is because the relationship with employment is incredibly important and we need to try and maintain that. But we can't do something for people who are still on the books of their employers and not recognise the 100,000 of people who are already on the emergency payment this week. So it isn't as simple as just saying, you know, we'll increase it to X.
I agree totally with you, Minister. It's
we will be
impactful
and we'll
There's
do it as quick as we can.
There's even other problems that say social welfare recipients, pre-disease social welfare recipients could then well be saying, well, I'm getting 200 a week and now they're getting 500. But we have to deal with those problems. They're unusual times. We need unusual measures.
Okay. I need to take a very quick break, but a point raised by Willie O'Dea, I think. He says, I've been contacted by numerous people, this is on social media he raises, unable to complete their online application form for job seeker payments because they don't have a public services card. Basically, the question is, people are telling him, I can't complete the application for this COVID payment because of the public services card.
Yesterday I announced, and actually, you know, it's a bit mad at the moment, is that you're announcing something at 11 o'clock and by 12 o'clock, it seems like it's a month ago.
Yeah.
So yesterday afternoon, we temporarily suspended the need for a PCS card for any of our schemes. And so that shouldn't be a problem right now.
Okay. Look, we'll leave it there. I know there's a million more questions, but we'll talk after the break. Muichas la pir starti o hin fein, agus 18 Hayden o threshold. After the break, we'll talk self-isolation and how so many people are coping. And we'll discuss that with the former president, Mary McAleese.
Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
51551. Tony Foley wants to make a really brief point about the total cost of this in terms of dealing with the economic impact.
Yeah, this is going to cost billions. I know the government programme was 3 billion before this is settled, and every country in Europe will be doing the same thing. We could have the public finances worsened by 30 billion, 40 billion. We have to live with that. We have to deal with it. And afterwards, we deal with it in terms of the refunding of it.
OK. You're not a good man for the old ticker, Tony Foley. I'll tell you that.
Well, I'll say one thing, though. We've had crises before. We got through them. Mm. We got through the mess in 2008. In 1950s, half a million people emigrated from the country. Ideally, we wouldn't have the crisis, but we do get over them. We will come back.
But
I think in
the teeth of a crisis, we need to listen to people who are sage, and we need hope and reassurance. And I believe we'll get that from Dr. Mary McAleese, former President of Ireland. You're very welcome to the programme, Dr. McAleese.
Thanks, Cormac. How are you?
Not too bad at all. How are you? You're among many, many people in the country self-isolating at home. How are you managing it?
I am. Well, we're by the banks of the Shannon, so Martin and I are very content here, and we're, you know, we want for nothing and need nothing. We, you know, everything that we need is available to us, whether it can be delivered to the door. We live very close to the town of Carrick and Shannon, which I have to say took really almost instantly all the measures that were needed and are needed to keep people safe, because the message. The simple single message here is clear. We can't afford to wait for a vaccine for this dreadful virus. The answer lies in our own hands in slowing it down. And there's only one answer to that, and that is isolation for those who are capable of isolation. That came very strongly home to me because up until a week and a half ago, I was working in Scotland. I was lecturing in the University of Glasgow, wasn't due home until the end of the month. Martin was due over for St. Patrick's weekend. We were going to have the weekend together there in Scotland. And I was listening to the sheer caliber and clarity of our experts and our advisors here in Ireland, you know, people like our government, like Leo and Simon, the two Simons, Tony Holohan, Sam McConkey, Paddy Mallon, Paul Reid. And their clarity stood in such contrast to what I was hearing in the United Kingdom, which was almost nothing. Nothing was happening. There was no sense of panic. There was no sense that this thing had caught out the entire world and was dangerous.
There was a sense of frustration, I think, among the people in the north as well. But on a very human level, though, Dr. McAleese, people who are self-isolating like yourself, parents around the country are saying this is difficult. Do you have any advice for people in terms of how to cope with adhering to the advice?
The first thing is we have to adhere to it. There is no other option. It's like there's a fire and there's an exit and we can't afford to go back in to get the family memorabilia. When somebody says get out, we get out. So we have to do what we're told here, and what we're told is very clear. Isolation for those who are in the privileged the privileged position of being able to isolate, which is most of us, not unlike those who have to keep the hospitals, the clinics, the pharmacies, the supermarkets, the chain of continuity of food, the people who have to keep delivering to us, all the people who can't afford to isolate, they are depending on us who can isolate to isolate. So we have to stay home. I know it's counterintuitive, and God knows it is particularly counterintuitive this weekend when, you know, we have mothers. My mother's birthday is also today, as well as Mother's Day tomorrow.
Happy birthday.
happy birthday, Mommy. And there would normally be, you know, she has 9 children, she has a bunch of grandchildren, she has a bunch of great-grandchildren. There would be a convoy heading to Restrever today for a family lunch that we have annually. We're not doing that now.
And Mother's Day tomorrow. Yeah. What had you planned?
And Mother's Day, God help us. And the thing is that we're doing that to keep her safe. We're keeping ourselves safe, and by doing that, we're keeping her safe. And that's the truth all around the country. By keeping ourselves safe. Now, I know it's counterintuitive. There's the temptation to do what we've always done, get into the car and go, and we just can't do that.
So do you share the same sentiment as one of the Simons you mentioned there, Simon Coveney in the Shannon, I think, yesterday, when he was talking about groups of young people not observing the restrictions? I mean, should they be confronted? How do you deal with people who just simply aren't getting the message? We had somebody telling us that there are throngs of people in the English market in Cork as well, and I'm sure throughout the country as well. What do you say to those people?
Well, the young people, it strikes me that we really need to get engaged in a conversation, particularly with our young adolescents, because just to go back to this situation of my mother was introduced for the first time in her life this week to using an iPad and FaceTime. And that's what we're doing. As a family, we're keeping in touch with her through FaceTime and with each other. We're having daily quizzes with each other. My friends, we had a quiz last night. Mary Kennedy won it again. we're doing all of those things to keep ourselves diverted, to keep ourselves entertained and amused, but also to keep in contact, because for us Irish people, contact is everything, community is everything, family is everything. So when that shuts down, we're left baffled and shocked, and so we need to be able to find other ways of doing that. Group on this island who know how to use technology to keep in touch with each other, it's our adolescents. And probably in the past we've said to them, would you put that computer away, would you put that blessed phone down, would you get out into the fresh air, would you go and play a game of football with your friends? Now we have to tell them that everything we've told them up to now, we want them to stop doing. We want them to come into the house, we want them to sit on their iPhones, on their iPads, and talk to each other. That's what we need them to do. And also, don't forget, they're coming. We also have a habit, I think, with our young people of trying not so much to absolve them from responsibility, but to keep them from worry. I'm very conscious that at the moment that in many, many homes, there are mothers, fathers, and adult children who've all lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, 2 weeks ago, they were all bringing a wage home. This week, they're not. And they are in real shock. And the virus, they know, will go away sometime, because that's a lesson we've learned from China. It can be dealt with in the longer term. But will their jobs come back? Will their lifestyle come back? Will their quality of life come back? They need a lot of reassurance. And I think our younger people, again, can help with that by giving the support, by showing their support to their parents, to their older siblings who've lost jobs, to their grandmothers and grandfathers who are worried about the future and the economy as much as they are at the moment about the virus. So, you know, I think many of us are in shock, but here's the trouble. We don't have time. We really don't have time on our side here to sit back and decide, are we going to conform to the best advice? Are we going to think about it? We don't have that time. Okay. Here's a moment when we just have to listen to the experts and do what they tell us, because there are two countries, it seems to me, that are giving us very important messages. From China, we know that at last they are creeping out from under this awful, awful virus. And so there's a good news story at last coming out of China. But there's also another story, and it's coming from Bergamo in Italy. And I'm sitting here looking across the Shannon, Cormac, at Ardcarn Church. I'm remembering stories that my grandfather told me about the ditch in front of his home, which I can see from my window here, where the famine bodies were 9 deep in the ditch leading all the way down to Ardcarn. And I have to say, when I was listening to the doctor speak and seeing the convoy of trucks with the dead bodies coming from the hospitals in Bergamo, and listening to the doctor there saying, there is only one answer to this. It's not in medics, it's not in medication, and it won't be for a long time in the vaccine. It is isolation.
Okay.
And so if we want to avoid the bodies, if we want to avoid the loss of the people that we love dearly, we're only asked to do a simple thing. Stay home. We have books. We have technology. We have things that they didn't have back in those famine days. We have we have wonderful supports. We have fabulous people who are out there doing their best. The least we can do is isolate ourselves.
Well, can I say you've put it better than most people could, and that's no surprise. And I thank you so much for taking a call, Dr. Mary McAleese. And go well, go safely, and please adhere the advice given by Mary McAleese. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you to all of our panel. I hope you heed the advice. And if you're in a crisis, we'll continue to ask the questions. But I think I get a sense that people in power know that there is a crisis and they're doing the best they can. But look, thank you very much indeed to Minister Regina Doherty, Sam McConkie, Tony Foley, John Bates, Aideen Hayden, Pierce Doherty and Dr. Mary McAleese. We'll be back next Saturday, please God, at 1 o'clock. Until then, stay safe. Bye-bye.
And Saturday with Cormac O'Hara was produced by Mary O'Hagan. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. Research was by Kieran Dunn, and Andrew Kane was on sound.